everybody. Welcome. Episode number 28 of the Bucko Cast of the, should I say new look Bucko Cast, Jason? Since we got a new logo going on here. Josh Taylor, Jason Rawlinson here.
Yeah,
facelift.
Yeah, fresh coat of paint on the wagon, never hurt anybody.
Yeah, I like it. Nice little contrast, little color pop there.
Yeah, I want to give a very quick shout out to the guy who designed it for us. He's done a lot of logos for me in the past. His name is Jay of Starchick. The spelling is a little weird, so what I'll do is I'll link to his profile in the show notes. If anyone needs any graphic work, please look him up.
Excellent, man. It's good stuff. I'm a big fan. I remember you showed me a couple mock-ups of it, and I liked the first one you showed me. Then I saw the second one. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's perfect. So definitely great work. And so if you subscribe to the podcast, you'll see that logo come up on your phone when you subscribe, and you'll be able to give us your thoughts also. So definitely big stuff. We got a lot to get to, man. We got a lot to talk about here. We got some we have some sound incorporated from last night's game. The big comeback against the Tigers, and some people will probably say it's the Tigers, but a big comeback is a big comeback, so we'll hear some sound bites from that game, and it's going to lead into some of the topics that we're going to discuss tonight. But before we get to all that, plus we have our question of the week that our followers on Twitter have weighed in on as well, and we will pick a side, which we have done a couple times already, so we will do that. But before we do that, Jason's got a quick shout out to our friends over at the Pittsburgh Fan.
Yeah, I want to give a shout-out to Randy, the Pittsburgh Fan, for supporting our podcast, as always. Look, you're going to PNC Park anyway. It's right across the street. Why don't you just hop in, see what's new? They got all kinds of vintage clothing and contemporary clothing as well. Collectibles, keychains, hats, a lot of hats, actually, for all three Pittsburgh sports. So anything you can think of, they probably have it. So check them out, again, right across the street from PNC Park. Make it a part of your trip to PNC. You can visit them online at thepittsburghfan.com. And shoot him a follow on Twitter, why don't you? At the Pit, P-I-T-T, fan. At the Pit fan.
And if you're a hat guy like me, and you want to get a couple different color, different flavored lids, Pittsburgh Fan's a good place to grab some. I know I've gotten a couple from there. Another thing I'll say, personalized jerseys. My wife actually got a personalized jersey from the Pittsburgh Fan. A Sean Rodriguez jersey of all jerseys in the world. But true story, it was the day after the Pirates had traded for him and brought him back. And my wife was a huge Sean Rodriguez fan for a couple of different reasons. One, she met him and she thought he was really nice. Two, her mom's maiden name is Rodriguez, so she used to always joke that S-Rod was her cousin. So got her a Sean Rodriguez jersey, but we got it for her at the Pittsburgh Fan. It was reasonably priced, and she still wears it to this day. So shout out to those guys, definitely.
Yep.
All right, let's start with our leadoff segment for the show. Jason, the Pirates are currently in last place in the NL Central. 33-40 is their record, and if you want to go by their expected record based on their run output, it should be 30-43. So they're technically playing three games above their heads if you go by the math. Seven games out of first place, six games out of a wild card spot, and we've heard quite a bit of outcry already for this team to tear it down, start selling guys off, and already start looking toward the future. So with that in mind, now, we're not going to talk about a complete teardown, but if you were to make that decision, if you're wearing Neil Huntington's tie, so to speak, and you're sitting in his chair and you're faced with the decision of tearing this whole thing down, which player would be your first one to send out, regardless of his trade value? Which guy are you looking to move first right now?
Well, it's a tough one. Number one, I really don't think that a full teardown is anything Neil Huntington's even considering at this point. And I'll tell you
and
why.
I agree.
Yeah, I'll tell you why. Not just because there's still talent on this club and they can easily come back in 2020 and maybe put it all together, but this organization does not believe in windows. You know, they're trying to stay competitive each and every year. So to do that would be just a complete sea change in their philosophy, and I just don't see it right now. So with that caveat, I'm looking at the one-year guys or the guys on expiring contracts, and I'm going to go ahead and say, I'm sorry, Josh, but I think Melky's got to be the first one to be offered up. I do.
You and I have been talking about this for a while, and I dread the day that it happens, but it's pretty much what I've expected. I've expected Melky Cabrera to be the first guy to go. But I'm going to change my answer here a little bit, and only because of what he's done in the past couple weeks. And you mentioned how, you know, this team doesn't deal with windows, but there's a guy who's not necessarily on a one-year deal, but he's also due for an option next season. And when the year after that, now there's a $2 million buyout attached to that option if they decided to pick it up, but that's Starling Marte. and his value has completely taken an upward trajectory compared to what it was in the first month and a half of the season. So he has taken an upward swing. I kind of like what he's done in the past 4 to 6 weeks. I really like what we're seeing right now out of him. I thought he made a couple plays defensively last night that really showed off. If nothing else, that's what he's going to bring for you as far as still being an above-average defensive center fielder that can do some things that a lot of guys can't do. Plus, he's starting to show you the things with the bat that he's capable of. The speed is still there. And on the right team, I think he becomes a fixture where he does not have to be the guy, but he becomes a really good piece to your team very quickly. And he probably fetches you a pretty good return as well. So I'll go Marte.
Yeah, absolutely. And that would be my – if the Pirates were, I believe, doing a full teardown, that's the guy I would pick.
And okay.
I would not lose sight of the fact that because he has those options – and more importantly, because those options are team options, that really increases his value. You know,
right.
Let's say a fringe team thinks they can compete this year, so they go ahead and get Marte. Maybe circumstances show them that they're not as close as they thought they were. They can get out on that contract with a $2 million buyout. So that's adds a lot of value. Just one last thing on Melky before we move on. I'll say that another reason I chose Melky is because he's starting to slow down a little bit over the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks or so. Just looking at the last 2 weeks, hitting 250, not slugging the ball at all, 333. Still not striking out, but not getting on base either, on base of 250. So I would say maybe hide him a little bit and try to really move him while the value he's built is still there.
Totally agree with that. And Melky's a guy that can feed – he could probably fetch you an arm that could help you right now, whether or not it's a starting arm or a relieving arm. That's something that has to be worked out. But he can fetch you a guy that can help you immediately. Now, as far as Marte, you mentioned, I'm glad you brought up maybe a team that's on the fringe that can use a guy like him. I hear that, and the team that comes to my mind that makes a lot of sense to me, and this is based on his history hitting in that ballpark and what he could do there, he would make a lot of sense in Colorado.
Oh.
He would look really good as a Rocky.
Yeah.
I mean, Ian Desmond's in center field. He's there in center field now, and he's had a pretty good year, OPS plus of an even 100. But move Ian Desmond in the left. Starling Marte becomes your center fielder. It's Desmond, Marte, and Blackman already with Trevor Story, already with Nolan Arenado. That team looks a lot better immediately. And David Dahl's still there too, and he's a pretty good player also. So your outfield becomes a lot better. Your offense gets a boost. He probably goes to slot in that second or third spot in your lineup. He looks really good in Colorado. That's what I'm thinking if I'm making that move.
Let me humor you here a little bit, because when you mentioned Colorado, I have the perfect return for him.
Ooh.
From Colorado. Now, it is a prospect, but it's a good prospect. He's a left-handed pitcher. He's number 70 on MLB Pipeline's top 100 prospects overall. Number 8 in terms of top 10 left-handed prospects. I know nothing else about him except for this one last thing. And this gives me all the faith in the world that he'll be a great addition to the Pirates. His name is Ryan Rolison.
Wow.
So,
wow.
I'm not making that up. He's the Rockies' third-ranked prospect. He's not related to me. I don't know him. But, you know, I'd like to see him come in now. I think that's a plus in his column there.
That is fantastic scouting work on your part. I'm so impressed. That's amazing.
Thank you.
Excellent work. I can't even sum up any better than that. That's fantastic. All right, here's what we'll do. What we'll do is move to this next segment, and this is going to be a little bit different. This is something we haven't done before, and it just so happens that I finally made my first trip to the ballpark last night to catch the second game against the Tigers, and I said, you know, I'll stick around, maybe get some post-game sound, talk to a couple guys, and see what they would tell us. And I got to ask a question to Trevor Williams. I got to ask one to Corey Dickerson. They both talked in the clubhouse afterwards. And I got a chance to talk to Clint Hurdle and ask him a specific question. And we're going to use those questions I asked those three men to shape our questions for this week's show. And who knows, if there's a home series moving forward and I can make it down there, or Jace can make it down there, maybe this is something we'll keep rolling in the future. But it's a good little thing to throw in there for right now. We'll start with Trevor Williams. Makes his first start coming back off the IL. I want to say 33 days, I think it was.
Yeah.
He was on the IL and comes back, makes his first start. Mixed results. If I want to kind of give it a grade, that's probably a C, only because that third inning looked really bad for him, but it really came down to just one inning. I don't count the two runs in the first inning because I will make the case, and this is something we'll go into more detail later on in just a few moments, that if a tag play is made by a better tag play is made by Adam Frazier, maybe they don't score a run at all in the first inning. But that's something we'll get to in a couple of moments here. But after the game, I asked him a question just about how this offense has been carrying the team. And it really stems from what Stephen Brault said when they were on the road getting ready to leave Miami. And he talked about, you know, hey, the pitching staff, we pretty much didn't pull our weight. We didn't do what we were supposed to do, and the offense has been carrying us. But he also talked about how Brian Reynolds was, quote, stupid good, which I thought was hilarious. But Trevor Williams, after his start last night, did not really sound much different. He sounded very similar to what Stephen Brault's sentiments were about the offense and how they've really been able to help the team, especially in spite of the pitching being as inconsistent as it has been. And here's my my quick chat with Trevor Williams.
Reynolds pretty much making up that lead after it got behind you guys. Being able, not just as a starting pitcher, but just watching it from a teammate standpoint, seeing these guys continue to battle back and get leads back, how fun is that on your end?
It's awesome. They've been picking us, the pitchers, up a lot. They have, and it's tough giving up those runs because you didn't want to get too out of reach to spoil a good offensive day. You know, we battled back and we chipped away, and you know, it was fun to see as I was sitting on the bench. You know, there was never a doubt in our dugout that we were going to come back and win this game. You could see the ABs that guys were putting on, the way that they weren't throwing at bats away, and you know, we chipped away until the very end. And it's fun to watch that as a starting pitcher and as a teammate. And obviously, you know, I'm loving every second of it because they really did pick me up today, and I was so very
okay.
That.
So that's Trevor Williams, and that's what he had to say about the offense and how good it's been, and specifically about Brian Reynolds. He did a lot of great things to say about Brian Reynolds. I thought that was really great of him to really prop the young teammate up, prop up the young rookie. But here's my question to you, Jason. Barring any trades over the next few weeks, is this recent lineup, and I'll go primarily this 1-6, with Kevin Newman, Brian Reynolds, Starling Marte, Josh Bell, Colin Moran, Corey Dickerson, and if you want to slide in Elias Diaz at 7, it wouldn't be a bad idea. That 1-7, Newman, Reynolds, Marte, Bell, Moran, Dickerson, Diaz. Is this the best lineup we've seen all season?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. You know, as good as Melky was playing early in the year, as decent, and I use that term loosely, as Polanco looked when he first came back, they weren't really mashers. They really couldn't be counted on to just go out there and produce and drive those runs in and get on base. And Moran as well, adding him in that group as well, has really turned it on lately. And then you have Kevin Newman, who with a slight change in his stance, just inching in a little closer to the plate, has been able to put more barrels on balls and really blossomed. So yeah, I love the 1-6 of this lineup, especially obviously Bell's been doing what he's been doing, and Marte, like you said at the beginning, has really just been turning it on lately, and he provides excellent protection right in front of Bell with the way he's batting. So I love it. I really do. I think it's very dynamic. And if you want to just say, you know, okay, Dickerson, you know, like you said, the triumvirate of Dickerson, Melky, and Polanco,
yep,
make them a three-headed monster and see what you get from the bottom, I really like it. I think you're absolutely onto something.
It makes a lot of sense to me, especially with specifically those six guys, because if you have Melky, he's probably going to be your number one pinch hitter coming off the bench, which I'm totally okay with. If Polanco's going to rotate in and start maybe a day or two, I think that sixth spot makes a lot of sense for him. Not as much pressure there. He's coming behind the guys that are pretty much expected to do a lot of the heavy lifting, so that makes sense to me too. So it just seems like it makes perfect sense to slot those three guys together. Or if you really need to sit Reynolds down, you can have Melky hit that second spot and probably not miss a beat. Especially as far as matchups go, having a switch hitter there. Now, granted, is Melky hitting on the same level as Reynolds has been hitting the past month or so? No, but he's still been pretty productive. So even if you sit Reynolds for a day and give Melky that start in that spot, that still makes a lot of sense to me. I think it's really interchangeable, and it just makes a lot of sense right now, given what Newman's done at the leadoff spot, given Reynolds being pretty much, besides Bell, their best hitter right now at 2, makes a lot of sense. Marte, I think, is really heated up at 3. I think he's found a really good fit there. Bell at 4 pretty much speaks for itself. He is their best run producer. He is their best power source right now. It all just makes sense right now. Moran at 5, I still love this. And even if you want to put Jung Ho Gung in there, let's say you give Moran a day off and you want Gung, or you want the platoon advantage against a left-hander, you put Gung in at the 5th spot, and I still don't hate it because Gung's starting to show a little bit of power. I thought the double that he hit down in Miami, I want to say that was Friday night, maybe it was Saturday, but that 98 mile an hour fastball in the inner half that he just ripped down the line for a double and scored a run or two, I think that's really useful for him. So for that lineup right now, it makes perfect sense to me. I like all of this right now as it's stacked up.
Yeah, and Moran has been swinging the ball a little better against lefties lately. Still an extremely small sample size, just 24 plate appearances on the season against lefties. So Clint doesn't really trust him right now against them that much. But I think, I don't know if it was last night or the game before where Clint kind of mentioned that he's been hitting the ball much better against lefties. And right now, hitting .333 against them. Again, 24 plate appearances, but you know, maybe with Gong still not looking to be anything like the Pirates thought he might be after going down to Indianapolis, maybe you see Moran get a few more opportunities against Southpaws.
And I'd be okay with that. I'd be okay with it. I'm also okay with the thought of even if you do start Gung, you have Moran coming off the bench, is probably your best left-handed bat. Let's say you sit Dickerson for that day. He's probably off the best bench as your best right-handed bat. You still have Melky, who's a switch hitter. You also have Polanco as a left-handed option if he doesn't start. So your bench looks a lot better, even when we're talking about this configuration as far as potential pinch hitters and guys that can help you off the bench. So that really helps a lot, too. So not to mention the fact that Pirates pinch hitters have been pretty good, which is, I don't know how much you make out of that. I don't know if it's important to you or not, but it's something you keep in the back of your mind. So you have at least a good starter and bench configuration as far as guys that can help you as pinch hitter. So I really like that configuration a lot. Next person we'll bring up is Corey Dickerson. Got a chance to ask him a quick question. And I asked him specifically, and this is based off of something that Trevor Williams had said. He talked about how, you know, how everybody on the team just had the same attitude. They never felt like they were out of that game. Even last night being down 7-1, there was never a doubt that they can come back and get in that game. Of course, Dickerson with the two-run double makes it 7-3. Marte hits a two-run home run, and he just completely blasted like a laser down that left field line and over the bleachers. I mean, 107 miles an hour. That was just an absolute bomb. And then you have the three-run shot by Reynolds, which is the difference maker in the game. But Trevor Williams said how this team never really had any doubt, how they always believed that they could come back, and eventually it pays off in a victory. So I asked Corey Dickerson about that, and this is what he had to say.
To come back for you guys and get back into this game, how important is that to carry that forward, even dealing with everything you guys are facing right now?
I think it's huge. I think, you know, guys coming off injuries, there's different mindsets, different thoughts going through our heads, you know, as players, and to be able to come together as a team and have one common goal is, you know, sometimes, you know, tough when you're going through a hard stretch. And, you know, for us to battle together and watch Trevor battle out there makes you want to battle at the plate. You kind of feed off of it, and, you know, it's a good team win. And
hopefully. All right, there's Corey Dickerson, and talking about the team maintaining that attitude, that intensity, and not giving up despite their position right now in the standings and their win-loss record. So with that in mind, Jason, I'll ask you this. Given their situation right now with players like Dickerson, like Trevor Williams, coming back from injury, and there's still only six games out of a wild card spot. I know a lot of people don't like their future prospects right now as far as the rest of this season, but mathematically they're still very much in it. Should they give it the old college try until the trade deadline, or should they start looking to shed movable parts right now?
Well, it's tough because, you know, they're hanging around within, I guess you can call it striking distance, right? I mean, of maybe a second wild card, theoretically. Stranger things have happened. But I don't think they should really just say, get on the phone right now and say, yes, we're going to sell. I think that it's coming soon, and I'll tell you why. So in June, they just wrapped up a split two-game series with the Tigers. They go to San Diego for three games. Then you come back, and you've got three against the Houston Astros. And then, to close out June, you have three against the Brewers. And then to open July, you have seven games against the Brewers and the Cubs right before the All-Star break with a seven-game homestand. So that date being the All-Star break is July 8th. I think that is when you decide what you're going to do. Because at this point, you'll be able to see if you can claw your way back in the division with, again, six games against the Brewers, four against the Cubs. And maybe that'll help you decide either way. That's kind of what I'm thinking right now.
You and I agree on that. And we can talk about that streak they went on last year right before the trade deadline and how it might have been a little bit of fool's gold, and I wouldn't disagree with that. And maybe they shouldn't have thought to try to be as aggressive to get a Chris Archer. But at the same time, I would have never expected them to do something like that, to make that kind of move. That's one trade we would have never given them credit to even try to go after, even though in hindsight it looks a lot worse than it did at the time.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you mentioned it. You have a chance to make a lot of hay in the division. You're looking at 10 games against division opponents, you know, between now and the All-Star break. And it doesn't help that July 8th, you're going to watch the Home Run Derby and your best hitter is going to be a part of it. So that might give you a little bit of extra hope too. So with all that said, I do think given the fact that you have this many division games coming up between now and the All-Star break, you have to at least give it till then. And this has nothing to do with the numbers. This has nothing to do with potential trades. This has nothing to do with whether or not you can upgrade. This doesn't even have anything to do with injuries. This has to do with the guys inside that clubhouse. You owe it to those guys to at least give them a chance to make their own case to stay in it. If for no other reason, give your guys that opportunity to at least fight for themselves. Yeah, they got to go to Houston and play three games, and they're going to start that very first game. Guess who's starting? Gerrit Cole. I get it. That's not fun. It's not a fun scenario. Then you got to go to Milwaukee for three games right after you leave Houston. That's even less fun. I get that too. But you still get the opportunity to square up with Milwaukee for three games and then face the Cubs at home for four. So that's the thing you look at. After you get through Milwaukee, you at least get the chance to play seven games on your home field where your winning win percentage needs to get better, by the way, because they have not been great at home.
No, they haven't.
So if anything, you look at this six-game road trip and say, well, maybe they'll do better because they're not expected to, because they've actually done better than expected to on the road already. So maybe that's one thing you look at. But if nothing else, you have to let this team – you got to let them sink or swim. And if they sink, fine. It's pretty much what people are expecting anyway. I don't think there's any shame in saying, you know what, this didn't work out the way we wanted it to. Let's try to at least, if not reload, at least retool for next season. But if they do that, and I know some people will say, well, you want the same thing to happen as last year? Not necessarily. Not necessarily. But if that is the case, and they at least give you somewhat of a presence this next, I guess that's what, 13 games, if I'm doing my math correctly?
Yep.
If that does look better over that stretch, and let's say, and let's take the Houston games out. So we'll say those 10 division games. Let's say they go, what, 7-3 in those 10 division games. You feel a lot better about it because, especially if three or four of those wins are against Milwaukee, because that's three or four games that they're gaining ground on them in the division. So that makes it a lot better. However, if that does not happen, then yeah. Then you could talk about what you want to do, who you want to get rid of, when you're ready to see some of the guys come up from AAA and start working towards next year, but not until you get to that point.
Yeah, and if you want to get really wild, if you're Neil Huntington, after the All-Star break, they have a six-game trip, three against the Cards and three against the Cubs. Then you come back home, and here's where it gets a little interesting. Three against the Phillies and four against the Cardinals all at home. So right. Not only is it division games, but you're also looking at teams that are directly above you in the wild card with the Phillies sitting there as well. So that takes us to July 25th. So let's say, like you said, they come back 7-3 on this 10-game stretch. Maybe you call it a temporary stay of execution rather than committing one way or another.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense to me to at least stay the course for now. You're probably going to end up shedding some parts anyway, whether you stay in it or not. I mean, you're not going to keep a guy like Corey Dickerson one way or another. You're probably not going to keep a guy like Melky one way or another. So you're probably going to shed some parts one way or another. It's just a matter of if you're going to shed a couple of extra ones later on, or if you're just going to shed the expected ones when the time comes. Other than that, you owe it to your guys to at least try to play their way in or at least play their way out. Mm-hmm. Now let's move on to Clint Hurdle. This is something I talked about just a few moments ago with Trevor Williams in that first inning. That leadoff double by Jacoby Jones, former Pirates farmhand, there's that. in the first inning that went to left center field, I believe it went to left field. Corey Dickerson cuts it off. Great play by Dickerson to cut that ball off and keep it from getting past him for a legitimate two bases. Gets the throw into second base. Throw is on time. Adam Frazier turns around, and instead of tagging the lead foot, he tags the trailing foot, and Jones at the being safe. They looked at it for a second, and it was pretty much confirmed that he was safe. But then later on, you have Castellanos. Nick Castellanos in the seventh inning. He hits one to left center field. Marte gets to it. Really strong throw. Gets it into Frazier. Frazier gets that tag down and cuts down Castellanos in the seventh. And that saved a potential run as well. So that made you feel a little bit better, at least if that happened on the back end. But I'd argue if he makes that same tag play on the front end, maybe Trevor Williams doesn't give up two runs in the first inning. But with that said, I talked to Clint Hurdle. Well, I should say the media talked to Clint Hurdle after the game. But I asked him this question in particular just about what he saw from those two plays, both the play on Jacoby Jones in the first inning and the play on Nick Castellanos in the seventh inning in regards to Adam Frazier. And here's what Clint Hurdle had to say.
I haven't looked at the replays, so on the field it's a quick look. You're talking about the one where they were safe, and then the one where they're out? I haven't looked at it enough to try and comment. I know how we want him to set up, and I know how Adam wants to set up. Sometimes the throw takes him to different spots, but he's not afraid of contact. He usually sticks his nose in there. So what I also liked was the play Marte made earlier in the game, that we probably got one guy that can go make that play and go get that ball in towards the notch. So
that was Pirates manager Clint Hurdle. Some might say it sounds like he was trying to protect his guy, and I wouldn't disagree with you, because that was the first thing going through my mind, because I'm sitting there going, wait a minute, you didn't get a good look at it, but they reviewed the first one, so how good of a look did you really get? So that kind of stuck out to me too. But, and this is totally recognizing the fact that I wrote a chapter about this man before the season, and for some odd reason, he just lives to prove me wrong, whether I say good things or bad things about him, but I got to ask the question. Should the Pirates move on, Jason, from Adam Frazier and look toward the future at second base? Is it time?
No. I'll say no. The reason why is because up until this last week where he was, what he had God knows what in his head over those couple plays, and actually, technically, still, this is still true. He's your best defender in terms of defensive runs saved. He's a plus six at second base. He's played all of his time there this year. So if you want to just go by that, you know, maybe I'll say no. And he has a little bit more range than we thought, like you alluded to in the book prior to this year. So I don't know. I think you give him a chance to maybe see if he can get past it mentally, this rough couple days and this rough week he's had at the position. But if his bat continues to be absolutely just not there, I think that maybe you consider moving Kevin Newman over to second and maybe bringing Cole Tucker back up to get those reps. Or maybe even Gong if he gets hot and you want to keep him in the lineup and play a little bit of shortstop. That's a solution where you put at least as good of a defender there and a much, much better bat there, and you can also have some benefit to your organization by having Tucker, again, get those reps or even... Tucker get those reps, or even Gong, if he gets hot, take advantage of that as well. So there's a lot to think about, but in terms of just a statistical perspective, he's been your best defender if you listen to those stats. So it's a sticky wicket for sure.
I don't know if I should pat myself on the back knowing that he's been their best defender statistically, or if that makes me feel terrible about the rest of the guys around him. I haven't figured that out yet, because that's kind of scary to me. This is coming from the guy who wrote a chapter about Adam Frazier, about how he could be a major league second baseman and how I was wrong about him for thinking otherwise. I think Adam Frazier is going to have days when he frustrates you defensively. There will come that play where it seems like maybe just his head was not there, or he just didn't make the right reaction, and that came in the outfield too. And I think it's safe to say that Adam Frazier's value is not going to be tied up in his glove. Adam Frazier's value is tied up in his bat. The fact that he's hitting eighth right now, after being the leadoff hitter for so long, was probably the leadoff hitter for too long, in my opinion, as far as waiting for them waiting for him to be shifted down in the lineup. So I like the arguments on both sides. I like the argument of keeping him because statistically it makes sense. I don't like the thought of him still continuing to at least not hit as well as he probably should, or at least as well as we know that he's capable of. That's still something that bothers me a bit. At the same time, you know, you look at the full picture of what he's been, and honestly, I think he's managed to at least move in a different direction in the past couple of weeks. He started to uptick a little bit better. Is he still at the level that he should be? No. I don't expect him to stay. I didn't expect him to stay down that long forever. But there is still a bit of an expectation, if you will, for him to maybe tick up or towards the end of the season. He is a better second half performer. This is pretty well documented, so there's still that too. But I like the thought. This is on the other side of the argument. I like the thought you're throwing out there of Newman at second, Tucker getting more reps at short, getting more comfortable, and he was a guy who was really starting to figure it out and get a little bit more comfortable at the plate before he got sent back down. So if you're looking at Newman and Tucker moving forward as your future middle infield, I really like the thought of that. I really like both guys having impacts both defensively and offensively. We know what Newman can do with the glove. He made a great play last night at short. We know what Tucker can do at shortstop, so that just really sounds great moving forward. But for now, you might want to ride this thing out with Adam Frazier for now, just because you got a lot of other guys in this lineup that could still do a few things. And like we mentioned, you're not ready for the teardown effect yet, so you're not ready to go there just yet. In the meantime, maybe you stick with them just for the foreseeable future and see how your fortunes go in the meantime.
Yeah, I'm just going to add a little bit on Frazier. So I actually wrote about him for a piece that is publishing Friday on DKPittsburghSports.com. And what I'm finding with Frazier at the plate is that he's artificially trying to inflate his launch angle. So if you look at him last year, when he came up back up from a AAA demotion, that was on July 25th. So from that point through the end of that season, you know, he slugged 20 doubles, had something like, I think, 8 home runs and maybe a triple or two thrown in there. So all of a sudden, you had a guy who can go for, you know, what is that, like 10 extra base hits a month? But now, this year, if you look at his swing, he's trying to do the uppercut swing that served Josh Bell so well. But the fact is, he can't make solid enough contact. He has no hard hit rate to speak of. So all he's doing is just lifting the ball in the air, and it's not getting driven out, you know, not only out of the ballpark, which you don't expect from him, but it won't even find a gap. So I think he needs a complete overhaul in his swing before he can really uptick. But, you know, until then, he can maybe tread water and, you know, give you, you know, at least some decent defense, I suppose.
Yeah, I like him more as a line drive type of hitter. I like him better when he's spraying all over the place and he's finding gaps and getting extra bases here and there. I don't need Adam Frazier to be a 20 home run hitting second baseman, nor do I expect him to be that kind of player. What I do like is for him to hit 25 to 30 doubles. I'll take that. I'll take a triple or two here and there. I'll take him putting the ball in a gap and getting on base and then scoring position. That is something I will take from Adam Frazier. That's something I would expect from him. So, yeah, the fact that he's, you know, tried to overhaul his swing, like you mentioned, so maybe an overhaul of the overhaul is actually in question, or it should be in order right now. So with that said, a couple sound bites there from the Pirates, and something we'll bring back in future episodes. Hopefully we'll keep that rolling. Next thing we'll get to, and this is our question of the week, and this is something that Jason put out there for our followers on Twitter, and we got some really good responses to it. And what we'll do is I'll read the question, I'll read some of the responses, and then Jason, you and I will give our responses to it too. And our question of the week on Twitter was, should the Pirates seriously think about trading Felipe Vasquez? And we got a lot of good responses both for and against it. Shout out to my guy Gavin, who says, absolutely, this core isn't going to win a championship without meaningful upgrades, and Vasquez is probably the most valuable trade chip that isn't a must-keep player. Cookiehead Jenkins, which is still one of my favorite names on Twitter of all time, says, I don't think you move 73. Reason being, he's still under contract until 2021 with two option years. And in my opinion, this team can contend next year if some other moves are made, giving them a need for the big closer. Notice they aren't using him as much, saving his arm for next year. Couple other people. Chris says no way. AJ says no. Pillsbury Joe Boy says most definitely. If you can acquire two top prospects, you certainly do it. Mike in Illinois says, this question has so many possibilities. It all depends on the return. If the Pirates are blown away, then you have to take the deal, and no one is untouchable. Those last two responses, Pillsbury Joe Boy saying, if you can acquire two top prospects, and Mike in Illinois saying, if the Pirates are blown away, That's where I'm leaning right now. If they get that you can't say no deal, then that's something I have to look at. And I looked at some of the trades involving some of the bigger name closers right now. I mean, if you remember, there's some of the guys right now that are among the top closers in the game that were traded just within the past couple of years. Blake Treinen was traded just recently to Oakland from Washington.
Yeah.
And he was involved with two other prospects in the deal for Sean Doolittle and Ryan Madsen. And I'm sure if I'm Washington, you probably want that trade back because Blake Treinen's been really good and the Nationals bullpen has been really bad. But that's been the case for a while now. Then you look at Edwin Diaz, who went, of course, with Robinson Cano with the trade from Seattle to the Mets. Of course, that involved Jay Bruce, Anthony Swarzak, and three prospects. So you see the price that involved those two. I imagine Cano had something to do with that big return of five guys. And then you think of the Aroldis Chapman trade. Him going from the Cubs to the Yankees, and the Cubs giving up Gleyber Torres, or the Yankees giving up, or excuse me, the Cubs giving up Chapman from the Yankees to the Cubs, forgive me. And then the Cubs giving up Gleyber Torres, Adam Warren, Billy McKinney, and Rashad Crawford. Me personally, and this is considering the fact that Vasquez, if you want to go by the numbers, he's tied for seventh in the game and saves with 17. That's considering the fact that he seldom gets used recently. He's fifth in win probability added at 2.11. And here are the four guys that he trails. Will Smith at 2.98, Kirby Yates at 2.95, Josh Hader at 2.54, and Scott Oberg in Colorado at 2.15. Those are the only four guys that are ahead of him among all relievers in win probability added. So that's how good Vasquez has been. If that's the case, if you're going to move him, I got to agree with these two guys, with Pillsbury Doughboy and Mike in Illinois. If you're going to move Felipe Vasquez this season, a team better be backing up the Brinks truck. It better be closer to an Aroldis Chapman-type return than it should be for a Blake Treinen-type return.
Uh-huh.
I want to see four prospects, three prospects even, but that first one better be a can't-miss. Everyone knows this guy's good. You plug him in tomorrow, and he helps you tomorrow. And that's not even counting the fact that the other three guys better help you at some point in the near future and not the distant future. I don't want to see a Garrett Cole-type return. I don't want to see an Andrew McCutchen-type return. I don't even want to see a type return that you would have gotten for even in the Mark Melanson trade where you got a guy like Vasquez back and Taylor Hearn. I don't want to see that kind of return. It needs to be three, four guys, and at least one of those guys needs to be slam dunk, can't miss. Because if you're trading Felipe Vasquez, it's not like McCutchen and Cole and Neil Walker for that matter, when you're trading them when their value is at their lowest. You're trading him when that his value is arguably at its highest. So you better get the highest return possible for him.
Yeah. Now, before I go into the actual answer that I have for you in terms of Vasquez, you mentioned that Cookiehead Jenkins is one of your favorite Twitter account names or what have you.
It's a great name.
It is. It reminded me, we're just so off the rails here, but I don't care. It reminded me of a guy I used to talk to on Twitter. I could never take him seriously, so his username was at BigFarts420. So every time he would give me an opinion, they weren't all bad takes, but, you know, he would say something like, starting Marte needs to be released, not traded, no one will give up anything for him. And I would just reply with, thank you for your comment, BigFarts420. And so I just went to look him up on Twitter, and his account suspended. So now, I'm telling you, Josh, I'm going to record this podcast, and then I'm going to get on the case. I got to know what happened to my boy, BigFarts420. Anyway, and I just hope he's okay. I'll try to carry on with this podcast. Anyway, so
wherever he is, hopefully he's well.
Yes. So... Felipe. Okay, so Felipe Vasquez controlled through 2023, much like Marte. The last 2 years of that are team options for very low buyouts, actually $1 million in 22 and nothing in 23. And he only escalates to $5.75 million next year, and $7.75 million in 2021.
Exactly.
Here's why I'm bringing this up. I don't think that the return that you'll get today in 2019 for Felipe Vasquez would be drastically different than what you might get, let's say, in 2021. Because of that, I say hold. Now, when they do decide to trade him, they absolutely must get a major league piece back in return. There's no question about that. See if you can find, you know, a diamond in the rough like the Melanson or like the Rivero. But it has to be a major league piece in return and at least two of a team's top 10 prospects. That's kind of how I feel, because he's so good. There's really nothing in him. He's not, to this point in his career anyway, he's not really shown the volatility that you see with a lot of these high-velocity guys. Yes, mm-hmm. he'll have some stretches. He had a stretch last year, I think in May, where he didn't look quite himself, and then guess what? He just went back to work, and the rest of the season just had it locked down. So because he doesn't show the volatility that many other relievers show, and plus the fact that I think the return will be not drastically different in 2 years' time, I would hold on trading Vasquez.
You bring up a really great point with the value of that contract. $4.5 million this year, $5.75 million next year, $7.75 million the year after that, and then the two option years, $10 million and $10 million. That's a price tag that some teams would pay just top end relievers that weren't their closer.
Yep.
Depending on what market or what team you're in.
Mm-hmm.
So just imagine if a team wanted to trade for him and didn't want to make him their closer right now. He just might be their eighth inning guy because their closer might have a year left on his deal or maybe a couple years left. And he might go in being the heir apparent, the guy waiting in the wings at his next team. So when he gets to 2022 or 2021 and 2022, then you actually start paying him, or I should say 2022, 2023. That's when you actually start paying him closer type money. That's when he gets $10 million, but that's 3 years from now. So you could trade for a guy like him, not necessarily make him your closer, but he could be probably your setup guy, or at least the guy you bring in, even at any point. Even not to make him exactly an Andrew Miller comparison, but if he has to face the three best guys in your lineup in the seventh or eighth inning, he's the guy that comes in, he puts that fire out, and then eventually maybe becomes your closer down the road. You're going to get that guy at such a great salary that it's not going to matter what role you put him in, because no matter what you do with him, it's still a steal. And you got a good point. The return he gets in 2 years should be as good as what he gets right now.
Yeah, assuming he doesn't just fall off a cliff in terms of performance.
Yeah, if you're going to make that trade now for that contract, as much as people talked about Chris Archer and how great his contract was, Vasquez's contract and his value based on his contract is even better than that.
Preach.
So it better be a trade where if I'm Neil Huntington, I can't hang up the phone because what I hear is just that ridiculous that I have to say yes. Yep. That's going to be the reason why you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the only reason why you do it, in my opinion, at this point. But that's going to be the reason why you do it, because there's a team that says, you know what, we need this guy right now. He's literally the only thing we don't have. He's literally the only thing we need. We're set for the next 3 years. We'll give you these three or four pieces because we're not going to use those guys. They're all blocked, and this is the guy we need. So basically I'm saying if the Dodgers call you and say, yes, we want him and this is what we'll give you, that's probably the scenario that I like the most. And even then, I'd have to look and see if they even have prospects that I like. But if there's a team whose minor league system I'm looking at right now and seeing what they produce, it might be the Dodgers because they got some really good young players and they're making next to nothing right now. So maybe that's the scenario.
Yep.
But what we'll do, we got a couple more things to get to here. We will take a quick sponsor break. When we get back, we'll break down some more on the BuccoCast. All right, welcome back. Got a couple more things to get to here on the BuccoCast. Josh Taylor, Jason Rollison here with you. Episode number 28. We're going to ride out here with a couple good bits. And this is a couple of segments that we've picked up here just recently, but we liked them so much that we brought them back. First one is which comes first? And Jason, I'll ask you this question. Basically, what we do is I give two events happening, and Jason and I will decide which one will happen first chronologically. Number one. Stephen Brault falling back down from having the team's best starter's ERA, which is currently 3.38, or Chris Archer climbing out of the basement from having the worst starter's ERA at 5.85. Jason, which comes first?
I'm going to probably say that Stephen Brault will probably fall from having the best ERA in the starting staff before Archer puts it together. Archer's a mess right now. I think we can all agree on that, even though the last start showed some signs, if you want to be an optimist, but the past few starts, he's started to throw that sinker a little less. So just from that, I think that there'll be a couple starts left where Archer is going to have to still recalibrate himself in terms of going back to being basically a fastball slider pitcher. But in the meantime, I think Stephen Brault, while I don't think what he's doing is a mirage, he's made some real changes to his fastball in terms of release point, in terms of pitch mix and mixing velocity and location. So what he's doing is not necessarily a mirage, but I think the talent level that he has, which is, you know, obviously he's in the major leagues, but he's not what you would call a piece you'd build your team around. So I think that talent level, you know, will perhaps preclude him from just putting up ace-like numbers.
I agree with that. Water rises and sinks to its own level. I imagine the watermark for Stephen Brault is somewhat lower, considerably lower. That said, I don't mind the thought, and some people won't like this because I think some people's expectations are just ridiculous, but I don't mind the thought of Stephen Brault being a National League average starter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually okay with that. Do you realize what kind of career you can build if you are a left-handed National League average starter? You can actually be pretty productive, and you can actually be pretty useful to any team. Not to mention the fact that you have a pretty good career, too, because even after you're done starting, you can still make a decent career as a reliever for another 4 or 5 years. But that's where I expect Stephen Brault to land eventually. And that's given the fact that his last two starts, he's had 12 and a third innings, given up only 2 earned runs with 11 strikeouts. And granted, one of those games that he pitched pretty well was in Milwaukee against the Brewers. Now, the second one was on the road in Miami against the Marlins. But his last two starts have been pretty good. One's against a really good team, and one's against a really bad team. So if you want to meet in the middle, I'd say the middle somewhere around average. That's where I expect him to land. If only by default, I'll go with Stephen Brault. Number two, on which comes first, Keone Kella returns from the injured list, or Jameson Taillon returns from the injured list? Jason, which comes first?
Well, it's all doom and gloom for me because I think Keone Kella will return before Taillon returns. Jason Mackey and the PG had a good update. Well, not a good update, but a substantial update on Taillon and where he's at right now in his piece this morning. It seems like Taillon is in a cycle where he starts to throw and feels good, and then all of a sudden the pain comes back. And there's been terms thrown around such as shutting down, surgery, all those black nebulous terms you never want to hear. So because of that and that alone, I'm not very faithful that Taillon will pitch any more meaningful innings for this club. Maybe September at this point. I mean, maybe I'm, again, taking the doomsday approach, but I did not like what I read this morning. And if you read between the lines, from guys like the Todd Tomczak, the head trainer for the Pirates, and Neil Huntington as well, they know they have to take their time. They know they cannot rush him back. And especially if they fall out of the race over the next 2 weeks, I would not expect him to pitch a meaningful number of innings, let's put it that way.
I have to agree with that. And full disclosure, I'm Team JMO. I've been Team JMO for a few years now. So just to put that out there. But all that said, this is one of those guys that you cannot risk doing something that aggressive. They already tried to do something aggressive by risking Gregory Polanco, and the results were not good. They have not been good, and I don't like them as far as what those results have been, and I don't like the process behind it. I didn't like the decision to try to be as aggressive with him, and I think it's really come back to bite them. And I'd feel even worse about that, and I'd feel even more strongly about it if they tried it with Jameson Taillon. This is a guy you not only need, you know, for the immediate future, you're hoping he could be here for multiple years. You're hoping he's a guy that even if you're not in it now, if we're talking about trying to rebuild, if we're talking about trying to retool, he's one of the reasons why you're going to be able to do it faster than otherwise. So I would definitely agree with that. I think Keller gets the return before Jameson Taillon does. Number three, an outfielder gets traded or a player from any other position group gets traded. So basically we're saying outfielders versus the field. Jason, which comes first?
Are we talking within the Pirates or within baseball in general?
Within the Pirates.
Okay.
The Pirates outfielder or any other position group.
Okay, this is a slam dunk. This is an outfielder getting traded first. We talked about, I think Melky might be the first one off the board, but Dickerson seems to be getting showcased right now.
Yes.
Starting to respond. So I'm going to say definitely an outfielder here.
I agree. This is it's a no-brainer. It's an outfielder. Like you mentioned, Dickerson's getting his looks. Melky's going to help somebody. There's somebody out there that wants him. And plus, there's still that back of the mind thought of, like we mentioned before, a Marte with a team that could use him. And he's starting to look a lot better, and his stock is starting to raise a little bit, and his contract doesn't look too bad either as far as guys that can help you and how much it will cost for him to do the same. And plus, here's the thing that also sticks out if you're the Pirates. If you get a good enough offer that makes sense to you and you like the return, you already have his heir apparent, because Brian Reynolds is already there, and he's already showing he could hit, at least on the big league side of it. Even if the defense isn't as good as Marte, the bat has been pretty solid, and the defense isn't too bad. So there's a lot of things that point to Marte being one of those guys, too. So I agree, it's definitely an outfielder before it is any other position group. And last on which comes first, Mitch Keller gets called up again, or another top prospect gets called up. Jason, which comes first?
Well, it's interesting because JT Brubaker, who has pitched very well the past year and a half, 2 years in the Pirate system, would have been their number one depth option beyond, you know, the Brawls, the Kinghams of the world in terms of a starting pitcher. So basically this question to me, and JT Brubaker got injured this year with a forearm strain, is starting a rehab assignment right now. So the question for me really becomes Mitch Keller versus JT Brubaker if he can get back quick enough. So I'm still going to say Keller because his last start showed some things, threw a few more curveballs. I wrote about him today, and what I find is the stuff is there. The fastball has life. The curveball, he's still learning how to pitch to major league hitters, I think, because the movement is just all over the place. Sometimes it hangs. Other times it drops maybe a little bit too much, and then it's like Goldilocks, and there's not much porridge that's just right in terms of his curveball.
I like it.
I pulled it out of, I don't know where I pulled that one out of, but so I still think the Keller is showing a lot progressively over his last two starts that he might be the guy to call up. So I'll say Keller with a big asterisk that JT Brubaker is like right there.
You know what? The ultimate answer to this team, the ultimate answer to this question is going to be an injury dictates what happens. If someone gets hurt, you call up the next guy that makes sense for you, and that's who actually answers the question. But outside of that situation, it better be Mitch Keller. The next guy you call up better be Mitch Keller in terms of the guy that best helps you now for what you need. It better be Keller. It only makes sense, especially if a reliever gets hurt or you have to maybe shift brought back into the bullpen. I don't think they would do something like that. But let's say if that situation arose, if Brault just continued to, instead of continuing to progress, he kind of fell off a cliff and you needed a starter to really hold that spot. It better be Mitch Keller. He better be the guy. So I will say Mitch Keller definitely gets called up again. I think that one comes first. So that has been which comes first. We will go to our last segment. This one is probably a little bit more fun than the previous one. This is one that we've had a little bit of fun with at its outset, but we're going to mix a little bit into it too. We will start for Pick a Side, which is the name of the segment, by the way. We will start with this particular topic, and we're going to let Clint Hurdle talk about it for a second here. Trevor Williams, having his first start, coming back, 7 runs allowed in 5 innings. We talked about it before, how the first 2 runs probably weren't his fault because of some bad defense. He had one bad inning where he gave up a couple home runs. He gave up 5 runs, and it kind of came back around on him. But here's what Clint Hurdle had to say with his initial impressions of Trevor Williams' first start back from the injured list.
What did you think of Trevor's performance this evening?
He got better as he went on, and that's probably always going to be the operative of these guys come back. They need to pitch to get better. And that was the thought process on letting him hit in the fourth and pushing him back out there to see if we get some more pitches, get some more rhythm. Fastball execution was sketchy early. The breaking ball kind of came and went, threw some good ones, and he threw some that were kind of flat. But it just got better. Just got better as he continued to pitch. In the one inning, they made him pay for some mistakes. They got on him early. I thought he did a real nice job of management. The second run, just a fisted fastball. But, you know, that competitive edge out there, he had to work, and I think he got a lot of work in, a lot of positive work. Because the other thing, he retired 10 guys in 3 pitches or less.
Okay, that's Clint Hurdle. That's his thoughts on Trevor Williams, which leads to my question, Jason, or at least my take that you and I will pick a side on. Trevor Williams will be just fine after his first start off the IL. Clint Hurdle seems to think he will be fine. But Jason, pick a side.
Well, I'm going to say yes, but with a heavy, heavy asterisk. So if you look at his pitch usage yesterday, it was all four-seam fastballs, really. 40 out of 69 pitches were four-seam fastballs. Mm-hmm. And that's his game. I mean, he can dot the edges better than a lot of people. But he also had a very nice weapon in that changeup and a slider that was coming back to prominence over the rest or the beginning of this year. So I'm going to see what happens in his next start because I think that's not an ideal mix for him. Overall, I think he'll get there. I think you saw enough there to really think that, his next start and going forward will be markedly better.
I agree with that. I think I'm glad you mentioned the use of the fastball, but the fact that it's his best weapon, the fact that he lives on the corners and he uses that to make everything else work so well for him. I thought Clint Hurdle talked about how, you know, after he gave up those five runs, after that, he retired 9 guys in a row. So it seems like it was just a matter of him making adjustments. And we've heard this quite a bit now over the last couple of years. If there's a guy who knows how to adjust to the situation around him and figure out how to get things done, it's Trevor Williams. So I think he will be fine. I have to agree with both you and Clint on that one. All right. Next on Pick Aside, Jameson Taillon is the latest of Pirates pitchers that will be a development failure. Jason, pick a side.
I'm going to say yes, because he took it upon himself to add the slider last year. I don't think we can ever forget that. There wasn't at least that I saw, any column inches or quotes or audio connected to anyone in the organization that said, yeah, we want him to throw a slider. Yes, they embraced it. But before that, he was just another guy they were trying to stick into the mold. And, by the way, before he got hurt this year, going back later last year, he wasn't really throwing the curveball that much, which is a developed weapon for him. It was all throughout his minor league career, all through his early pro career, and all of a sudden he dropped that. And yes, he got hurt this year, so he couldn't really throw it as much as he wanted to because he just physically couldn't do it. So, long story short, I'm going to say, yes, he is the latest in the line of failed development pitchers there because he took it upon himself to be a slider, to introduce a slider. Obviously, he had great results with it, to his credit, but he had to do it on his own.
Yeah, that's a good point. The fact that, like, his own, metamorphosis is kind of self-induced is a little bit disturbing. And I'll throw this in, too, and this is really neither his fault nor the Pirates' fault. Injuries have really become a really big part of the lack of development in his career. There was a Tommy John surgery he went through when he was pretty much one of the top pitching prospects at the time while he was in AAA, and he was expected to be the next guy come up. He had the elbow issues, and that was something that kind of slowed him down. Then he gets up here and has some issues on and off after he gets here. Of course, he had the cancer diagnosis. It seems like every time you turn around, there's just something medical in the way. That's just in the way for this guy. And it's not his own fault. It's not even the Pirates' fault. And if there's a reason why his career is going to be looked upon unfavorably, it's going to be because of some really, really awful luck. And I think injuries have a lot to do with it. Next up, Neil Huntington cannot be trusted to oversee another rebuild with this team. Jason, pick a side.
No, I don't think that's true. I mean, we forget that Neil Huntington has made, a trade with McCutchen that has worked out. He's brought up, he identified Trevor Williams as a piece he got for an executive. Now, this is going to inflame our listeners, but I'm still on the fence about the Gerrit Cole trade just because, it's a 6 years of control versus 2 years of control kind of thing for him. Or you could even say 1.5 because, of course, he'd be traded at the trade deadline because he's not resigning here. So I want to see. I still have to see what Musgrove does before I can call that trade. But then you have the pieces like the reliever chain, right? Melanson coming in for Hanrahan, Rivero coming in for, and now Vasquez coming in for Melanson. What I don't trust him with is being able to do it on the fly, like the Tampa Bay Rays do, who remade their team in the blink of an eye last year, and all of a sudden they're a legitimate threat in the AL East. They can't do that. He's not that reactive. His notion of rebuild is tear it all down for the foreseeable future, not just, okay, I'm going to do it in 2 years. And I know I'm oversimplifying things here, but that's kind of my gut feel. I don't think he's the kind of guy who can do it on the fly. And when you have these guys you've been talking about, like Vasquez, like Josh Bell, like Jameson Taillon, should he be healthy, you can't really take the long view. So because I don't trust him to do like that jumpstart kind of rebuild, I don't trust him to do it again.
Here's what I'll say. I think Neil Huntington has had his faults. I'd make the case that for every good move he's made, there's probably one or two bad moves that he's made. So you're going to have as much in the debit column of the ledger as you're going to have in the credit column of the ledger. And I don't think anybody would disagree with that. At the same time, I think people are using a lot of hindsight to talk about what he's done. I've heard some people say, and I've seen some things on social media saying that, you know, this latest rebuild with this team and them becoming a 3-year wildcard team was really no credit to him. And I look at that and I ask myself, do you remember what this pitching staff was before he made the changes that he made? Do you remember what that pitching staff was in 2013, 2014, and 2015? That pitching staff largely consisted of guys that Neil Huntington himself acquired. You talked about the reliever chain, and that had a lot to do with it. Jason Grilley is another guy among those relievers that Neil Huntington brought in. And we tend to forget about him because he was only there for a year. But Jason Grilley had a lot to do with that before he started to really fall off. But let's remember what that pitching rotation looked like in 2013, 2014, and 2015. A.J. Burnett was involved with that. Gerrit Cole was involved with that. Francisco Liriano was involved with that. So you got a guy he drafted number one overall. Yes, I know what the aftermath of his time was here. That's fine. But he drafted that guy number one overall, and he's showing like he's a number one overall pick talent. So at least he got that right. Handling him when he was here, maybe not as well, but at least the draft pick he got right. Liriano, low-risk guy that he came in and ended up becoming a pretty good move during the time he was a starter those first few years. Burnett, even when he came back for that bit of time before the injuries became an issue the second time around, was a guy who came here, was a low-risk guy, and became an impact. When he brought in Russell Martin, as much as we hated when Russell Martin left, we also hated when he came in here. And that was a move that Neil Huntington made. So we can talk about how that rebuild, if you're talking about, yes, Neil Walker and Andrew McCutchen, if you don't want to give him credit for Starling Marte, because Marte was technically there before Huntington showed up, fine. If you want to give Rene Gallo credit for that, by all means do so. But you're talking about just those three guys that stand alone. The rest of that team that was put together that went on those three wildcard runs were guys that Neil Huntington brought in, and we didn't like most of them when they happened. There was a lot of outcry about the guys that he brought in that made that team what it was at the time. And somehow he managed to make it work. And a lot of it had to do with that pitching staff. So when I hear people say, oh, well, you know, a lot of it wasn't because of him, I call crap on that. I call every word. I call BS. I call all of it. Because that pitching staff is not what it is, if not for him and the guys he brought in. Especially the low-risk moves that he made that people did not like at the time, but ended up working out. With all that said, if the rebuild is going to happen with this GM, some of the moves that we've seen in the last couple years are going to have to continue down the progression. What do I mean? We already saw the change as far as hitting coaches go. There's probably going to have to be a change in pitching philosophy. It's going to happen because what we're seeing right now is not working. There's going to have to be a change in pitching philosophy. There's going to have to be a change in how they develop these guys and what they have these guys do. Because for the last few years, it has not paid off the way it did maybe during those three wildcard seasons. So there's going to have to be a change of philosophy. I hate to say it, but Ray Searidge might have to be the guy that falls on that sword for that to work. But if he's going to be part of a rebuild here, there's going to have to be some guys that are casualties, and there's going to have to be some changes in philosophy, some change in the way they do things. If they do that, I think it's possible. So if the mic's smoking a bit, I had to take a minute. But there are some people that are just... Some people are confusing emotion with fact. I understand that there's some frustration with them. There's some frustration on my part with Neil Huntington. But let's stop replacing fact with emotion. This team is not a wild card team 3 years in a row if that pitching staff is not what it is. And that pitching staff is not what it is, both rotation and bullpen, if not for Neil Huntington. Let's stop lying to ourselves. Now that I've got that out of the way, I had to take a deep breath and get that out. A non sequitur, if you will, for our final pick aside topic. Mike Trout and his 70 career WAR at age 27. That's the highest ever through age 27 in MLB history. Mike Trout is quietly putting together the best complete career we've ever seen in Major League Baseball. Jason, pick a side.
Is there any other side to pick on this one? Seriously. And why is it so quiet? This guy has done nothing but he's won two MVPs, Rookie of the Year.
Should have had a third.
Yep.
Absolutely. Not for Miguel Cabrera winning the Triple Crown.
Uh-huh. And then had another two other second place finishes as well. So yep. You look at him and he can get on base. Obviously, he can. He has a high total of hits earlier in his career. Not so much now, but he was a threat to steal 50 bases. Hit 49 one year, and if he's healthy, can be a force on the base paths as well. Just a very complete ball player. It's kind of funny, he lost traction in our mind space because you have guys like Mookie Betts, you have guys like Cody Bellinger in LA, who are getting the headlines, and all of a sudden, you look up and oh, there's Trout with a 1.114 OPS, and by the way, that's his third straight season with the OPS above 1,000. By the way,
wow.
So I mean, yeah, he's going to be. They should really cancel the 5-year waiting rule and just induct him the day after he retires because in the Hall of Fame, because that's how dominant he's been. If he falls off a complete cliff, you easily have the argument, you know, the Hall of Fame guys. I was talking about this with a guy today. There's the compiler guys who just hang around forever and compile stats. There's the peak guys who have, you know, 6 or 7, sometimes 8-year windows where they're the best in the sport at their position. And that's what Trout had. So if he fell off a cliff tomorrow, he was still good in the Hall of Fame. That's how good he's been, and we need to remember that always.
Here's the crazy part when it comes to Mike Trout. He's number one, of course, in career WAR at age 27. I think he just passed, Ty Cobb, I think, was number two. Babe Ruth was 16th on that list. And the one argument I hear, oh, Babe Ruth, he's you know, the best of all time. You say Mike Trout's better than Babe Ruth at age 27? Yeah, significantly better. Now, in fairness, Trout's also played almost 900 more games at this point than Ruth played at age 27. That's fair. However, Trout has more home runs. Trout, significantly better defensive player. And, of course, there's the higher WAR. Now, at the same time, Ruth had a better walk percentage, had a better K percentage, if you can actually believe that. Actually had a better slugging percentage and had a better ISO at age 27 than Trout does. So if you're going by the rate stats, Ruth's going to look better. But I'm going to come back to what he's done as far as his home run totals, the stolen bases you mentioned, the defense, the career WAR. I think it was Jason Stark that wrote this piece. Pretty much Mike Trout, how his WAR was just continued to climb upward with every given game that he played, and pretty much how everything he did had an impact on the Angels in some way or another. And he pretty much cataloged it game by game. I thought that was phenomenal. I think that says a lot about him. So yeah, right now, up until age 27, he's putting together the best career in baseball we've ever seen. And it's not close.
Not even.
It's really not close.
Nope.
Unless you say Ty Cobb is close because of the WAR, but whatever. He is the actual total package. We talk about 5-tool players, a guy that could do this, or maybe he can't do that. Usually we talk about 5-tool prospects, maybe one or two kind of go by the wayside or aren't as strong as we thought they are. Not this dude. They're all there. All 5-tools are there, and they're all plus, and they're all on display. It's a no-brainer for me.
People need to pay more attention, no doubt about it.
I think the fact that he plays for the Angels hurts him.
Yes, West Coast.
I think it hurts him.
Yeah, West Coast, yeah. The games are late, plus the team isn't all that competitive during his time there. Yeah, you're right.
I hear people talk about how the Pirates wasted the Andrew McCutchen window. If the Pirates wasted the window with Andrew McCutchen, what the hell are the Angels doing with Mike Trout? if Pirates fans have reason to be mad about what happened with Andrew McCutchen's tenure, then if I'm an Angels fan, I should be livid right now. They should be going through Anaheim with torches. Because they are wasting what is right now the best career through age 27 in Major League history. I'm just saying.
And he signed through 2030, so let's see if it can turn around.
The good news is their window's a lot bigger than Andrew McCutchen's was in Pittsburgh, I guess.
Yes, absolutely.
I guess that's fair to say.
Absolutely.
That is it for us. It has been episode number 28 of the BuccoCast. Thanks, as always, you guys, for listening. If you like the podcast, definitely subscribe if you haven't already. If you really like it, tell all your friends about it. Tell them to subscribe. And by all means, check us out. We will be here again next week. And definitely check out the show notes, other details in there that Jason will leave that maybe we didn't discuss in detail during the show. But as always, Jason, good to talk with you again. We you and I talk baseball. It's always just too easy.
Yes.
And time disappears.
Absolutely. And you blink and all of a sudden an hour and a half has gone by. And you know, I'm hoping that our listeners will join me on my next endeavor. It's a new podcast I'm producing called Gas and Smoke, where I search for Big Farts 420. I find out if you love cereal, you'll maybe want to check this out. You know, we'll investigate it. We'll get on the road. We'll figure out. We'll ask the questions. We'll pound the pavement. We'll find the leads. We'll follow up. We're going to find Big Farts 420, and we're going to find out what happened to him.
Oh, that's fantastic. By the way, here's an alert that just came over my phone. Even Kawhi Leonard had to snap a photo of Mike Trout during tonight's Angels and Blue Jays game in Toronto.
Did he smile? Did he smile his smile?
I don't know if he smiled, but there were probably apples involved.
Okay. Oh, God.
All right. It was probably apple time. So there's that. That's it for us. See you next week.
See you guys.